My counsel is setting up. I'll ask our marshal to call the next case.
Now, hearing case number A240226, Raymond Pavlov versus Secura Supreme Insurance Company.
Counsel, both of you have been here before. Just a reminder, 15 minutes each for your presentation of your case in chief. 5 minutes is reserved for rebuttal. The only other comment I have is to remind you that the podium does have a under switch if you need to adjust it for your height or your speaking preference. And Mr. White, I don't want to rush you, but when you're ready, you can go ahead and approach the podium.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Kenneth White. I'm an attorney from Mankato, Minnesota, and I represent the appellant, Raymond Kvalvog, in this action. This case presents an opportunity for this court to further clarify and address the issues of the relationship between an insured and an insurer in a setting where the insured has expressed strongly and repeatedly a desire about how the litigation in which he is a defendant ought to be handled. There is no question in this case that Mr. Kvalvog expressly said that he was not interested in settling this case. He
expressly said that to his lawyer.
To his lawyer, yes.
Can I ask, before you get farther, I just want to clarify a couple of things. I don't believe the insurance policy is part of our record. Am I right about that? And that your arguments really don't turn on the language of the policy, but on broader insurance principles and law.
I believe that's, yeah, I do not believe that the policy itself is part of the record, Your Honor. I don't recall seeing it, but I wouldn't bet the mortgage
again,
payment on it.
Again, your arguments don't turn on that
My
policy.
Arguments do not turn on the language. The assumption that all the parties made was that this policy contains the classic "we control the world" language, some variation on it. The policies vary a little bit, but they all say once we become involved, we, the insurance company, control.
And also, I don't know that there's no indication. I haven't seen a reservation of rights letter or anything, but my assumption on this record is that Secura was defending without reservation.
That's my understanding as well, Your Honor.
Thank you.
So the issue here, though, is where the insured has expressly stated to counsel in this three-party relationship that gets really confusing, and our Supreme Court has really struggled with how to deal with it. How do you deal with a situation where the insurer and the insured have distinctly different interests? And here, the answer to that, I think, is, and the most appropriate answer, is that the insurer has an obligation to go to the insured and do exactly what counsel suggested at oral argument before the district court when he said that you can simply not submit the claim to the insurance company, and that takes care of everybody's interests. The insurer should have that exact obligation when it sees its interests or its goals in the litigation diverging so dramatically from that of the insured.
So do they have the authority to just fire that attorney? I mean, they wouldn't have that privity of relationship, or would they? I mean, I understand what your argument is, but what mechanism would get rid of the attorney that in this case your client did not want to have speaking for his interests?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure which attorney you're referring to. There are two
Secura,
attorneys involved.
The Secura, the provided attorney.
Well, my client up until the mediation was, as far as this record goes and as far as the complaint indicates, was satisfied with the work that Mr. Unke had done. What occurred at the mediation is that it's virtual, and my client and Mr. Unke basically are left out, and Mr. Connolly steps in, who is also an attorney, steps in and handles the mediation and
he's the claims attorney, right? I mean, he's the company representative.
He is the company representative at the mediation, yes, Your Honor. But again, under Minnesota case law, and we go all the way back to Togstead, you don't have to have a formal attorney-client signed retainer agreement in order to become the lawyer for someone. If you give legal advice, if you take a position on behalf of a client in a legal proceeding, or even in an office setting where you're just talking, you create an attorney-client relationship that can lead to liability. And so when Mr. Connolly took over...
What if the client doesn't know you're there? I mean, my understanding is there's also this weird nuance in the facts where perhaps your client didn't even know Connolly was part of this.
That's part of the allegation, Your Honor, but I don't think it changes the analysis any, because Mr. Connolly steps in and becomes the attorney for Mr. Kvalvaag, whether he discloses it to Mr. Kvalvaag or not. He becomes the attorney by his conduct. And an attorney can, by conduct, create an attorney-client relationship by taking a position in a legal proceeding, a mediation, on behalf of an individual who is significantly impacted and significantly harmed by the decisions that the attorney makes in proceeding on that particular legal matter.
Does it matter that Unke withdrew from representation after Connolly stepped in after mediation?
Well, I think that's an additional significant fact that a fact finder, if you get beyond the Rule 12.
It would have been different. You would agree it would have been different if he'd stayed on, right? I mean, then you have who's driving the ship.
Well, Your Honor, if the case had not settled and Mr. Unke had stayed on, then yes, we probably wouldn't be here because the case presumably would have been tried and the jury would have spoken and everybody would have lived with the result.
Well, yes, and the result could have been very, very bad. I mean, there was inadequate coverage, arguably. I mean, I know there's varying estimates of what Mr. Schwant's case was worth, but, I mean, I'm having trouble. I mean, I understand. I mean, this case is, this is the second appeal that I've been involved in arising out of this unspeakably tragic accident, and I fully am aware of that. But I'm having a hard time reconciling the claims here with sort of longstanding Minnesota law in terms of an insurer's duty with respect to third-party claims. And I mean, at the heart, the duty is the duty to defend and indemnify covered claims. These were covered claims. The insurance company did exactly what was supposed to be settled in a way that protected your client from any personal responsibility. What's the basis to create an additional duty?
Well, Your Honor, that shouldn't be the insurance company's decision if the insured has expressly said, I don't want you to resolve this case.
Well, that's a statement made to counsel, and I understand counsel has been sued. So isn't that's the claim where you make that argument about counsel, but how do we fault an insurance company for doing exactly what your client asked it to do when it tendered the defense?
Well, Your Honor, again, and I think the obligation on an insurance carrier ought to be to notify the insured and say, we've gotten information, and again, the record is not developed because we don't have all of Mr. Unke's communications with Secura. There is an inference that at some point Mr. Unke said, gosh, Secura, Mr. Kvalvaag really doesn't like the fact that we're even going to mediation and doesn't think we ought to settle this case. Assuming that inference to exist, and at the Rule 12 stage we get to make those kinds of inferences, assuming that inference occurs, now Secura knows as well. Once Secura knows, what is its obligation in relation to that information? And I would submit to the court that it's very simple. Secura letterhead. Dear Mr. Kvalvaag, we're going to mediation. We're going to look at settling this case in what we believe to be your best interests. If you disagree, you have the right to disclaim coverage, and we'll send you this form, and you can sign it, and then we're out, and you are at the financial, personal risk.
Is that really the what? you think the law of Minnesota should be?
Yes, absolutely.
And what's the strongest legal support for that? I don't know how it would work as a practical matter without, again, subjecting insureds to personal liability and then having second thoughts and trying to sue an insurance company saying, well, you didn't give me all the information or I would never have rejected your coverage. I don't know how, what, and I know you're asking for a precedential opinion. I'm just saying, what would this look like, the law you're asking us to create?
Well, Your Honor, I think it would be relatively simple. People sign agreements every day, and including in those agreements are agreements expressly stating that I've had the opportunity, I mean, the standard form settlement agreement at the end and mediation, I've had the opportunity to talk to a lawyer about this and, you know, I'm not following your advice, I'm following the advice of that lawyer or my own counsel. It would be very easy to draft that kind of agreement. So Secura sends a letter saying, we're headed for mediation. We think we may settle the case. We understand you have strong feelings about this. Do you want to disclaim coverage? Mr. Kvalvog sends a letter back or tells his attorney, who then tells the insurer, I want them out because I want to control the ship. And I'm willing to run the financial risk. Secura then says, okay, dear Mr. Kvalvog, here's the form. You sign it. You are now 100% personally responsible for whatever happens, whether you settle, whether you go to trial, whether there's 17 appeals up and down and you spend $1 million on lawyers.
Is there an aspect to the claimant and the underlying third, you know, the underlying plant here, Mr. Schwant? I mean, does the duty to defend, does the existence of mandatory liability coverage also implicate the underlying victim in a way that the rule you're proposing might implicate?
Well, Your Honor,
you know what I mean? Do you understand what my question is?
I understand. I think I understand your question.
If you let the insured disclaim coverage that might otherwise be available to the injured plaintiff, and we agree with you in that, and we create that rule, that has a, you know, an effect on underlying plaintiffs.
Well, Your Honor, it does in the sense that the underlying plaintiff loses the
insurance,
easy
which,
pocket, the insurance
well,
money.
Well, maybe the only pocket.
And perhaps the only pocket, not in this setting, but in other settings, perhaps.
But then you're totally eroding the entire statutory scheme of no-fault benefits, which is a part of what Judge Bjorkman is saying. Why would we have such legislation in place if you could disclaim and disavow yourself of coverage?
Well,
why should you have to get coverage if you can turn around and then say no?
Well, Your Honor, two responses to the mutual questions here. One, counsel at the hearing in front of the district court judge acknowledged that at the very beginning, Mr. Kvalvog could have simply not notified Secura, and he started defending it, hired Mr. Unke or whomever he chose, started defending the lawsuit, and Secura would never have become involved. Second, the risk of in any case is whether or not there is insurance coverage and how the insurance carrier ultimately decides how to handle a particular piece of litigation. That is a relationship between the insured and the insurer. Yes, there is a potential third-party beneficiary out there, but that third-party beneficiary relationship only comes into existence if the insurance policy applies. The injured party has the same risk if there's a reservation of rights letter. The insurance carrier
which
saying...
Which, again, is not our situation.
Which is not your situation.
Right.
But the scenario is identical that the individual who is claiming to have been harmed is in a situation now where there may not be any insurance coverage. And if there is no insurance coverage left to the devices of whatever assets may be available from other pockets. And the legislature has recognized that, at least in part, by establishing joint and several liability. And so we have ways to get around judgment proof or partially judgment proof defendants in personal injury and similar kinds of claims.
Can I ask, I see your time's running short. I'm not sure I understand the uninsured motorist aspect. I mean, I see it referenced in the complaint as there was this agreement out there, but I don't see like a pleading of injury damage, you know, of coverage, injury damage, a typical pled claim. Can you explain to me how this UM claim, which I think was originally sued out in the first litigation, what happened and how is that implicated in this case?
Well, Your Honor, the complaint is not as detailed as one might prefer. I will be the first to acknowledge that.
But this is a notice pleading state.
Exactly. And the party to whom notice is being given is involved. I mean, Secura knows what happened in the uninsured motorist claim. My understanding and what I believe the evidence will ultimately show and the inference this court can draw in a notice pleading state is that there was the typical agreement. Dear plaintiffs, we have, and I don't know what the number is, call it $500,000 just to pick a number out of the air. We have $500,000 worth of uninsured motorist benefits. We have four claims. We don't know who gets what. We're putting it out there, plaintiffs' lawyers. You guys sit down and cut a deal and tell us who to cut the checks for. And that as a part of that agreement, Mr. Schwant was supposed to receive $17,500.
And his lawyer said,
and
no,
his lawyer said,
I'm
we don't want it, give it to Mr. Kvalvog. Therefore, because, again, in a notice pleading state under an inference from the complaint.
That's and at a hearing where the insurance company said, oh, we missed that. We'll deal with, I mean, right? There's also some indication that at some point respondent admitted that they didn't move to dismiss that claim.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor, that in the oral argument, again, in the district court, in the transcripts before the court, counsel says, I missed that one.
And so we don't actually have a motion to dismiss the 17-5 claim, yet the district court dismissed the claim anyway.
Well, Your Honor, that's my position.
But answer the question, yeah, but you're way over your time.
Yes, I understand that, Your Honor, and I apologize to the court. Yes, Your Honor, that's our position. So we would ask this court to reverse and remand the matter to the district court for further proceedings and answer and so forth.
Thank you, Mr. White. You'll have a rebuttal, of course. We'll hear from respondent counsel.
May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Chris Wills, and I represent the respondent in this case, Secura. Secura respectfully requests that the court affirm the district court's order dismissing Mr. Kvalvog's complaint against it.
Can I start with a couple just high-level questions? So one of the issues that is troubling me with this case is it appears that there are a number of issues where your client broadly files a motion to dismiss, files a memorandum, talks about some of the claims, doesn't talk about other claims. The district court then dismisses the entire complaint, even those claims where your client did not assert anything in their initial memorandum as to that they were asserting those claims should get dismissed outside of a broad statement that the entire complaint should get dismissed. And now it appears that at our court, there's an argument, you are making the argument that appellant has waived challenging those issues when it does appear that at the very beginning of this process, your client didn't actually move to dismiss some of the claims. And I'm wondering what the appropriate procedure is for us in that context. And if you're arguing that it's an appellant waiver, what was appellant supposed to do in the context where really, it was the insurance company at the very beginning that failed to move to dismiss specific claims.
Judge Larson, this was a unique complaint. It was very lengthy. There were, I believe it was like 12 or 13 pages long. They were all single-spaced. It was a pro se drafted document, and a lot of the allegations that were being made were, quite frankly, difficult to follow. there were discussions about, here's what happened during the course of the Schwant litigation, here's what happened during the course of the prior wrongful death lawsuit that was brought. And so what we did when we filed the motion to dismiss was read through the complaint, do our best to distill what the claims were that were being made, and then say, here is our motion to dismiss. This is what we believe the claims are that are being asserted in the complaint. We got a response from Mr. Qualvog in an affidavit form that was 12 pages long that, again, kind of difficult to follow in terms of what his response to that argument was. And then we had a subsequent memorandum that was filed by an attorney that Mr. Qualvog hired between when the motion to dismiss was filed, when he filed his affidavit opposing the motion, and then when we had the hearing on the motion. And then we go to the hearing on the motion, and so our position, quite frankly, is, sure, it's a notice pleading state, but you have to provide some notice. And when the allegation is, well, you should have told me of my...
I mean, but then you're at the hearing and arguably making admissions that, at least for the, you know, $17,500 claim, that you missed it. And making that admission on the record, yet the district court is deciding to dismiss that claim.
And Your Honor, my comment on the we missed it, I mean, I'm the one who argued the case before the district court. I don't recall the exact language that I used, but what I meant was I didn't see that anywhere in the complaint. And when I went back and looked at the complaint after the hearing, I was like, okay, well, there are some allegations in there about some sort of a UM claim, which at some points it's described as a UIM claim, an underinsured motorist claim, and at other points it's described as an uninsured motorist claim. And quite frankly, Your Honor, the allegations in the complaint related to that claim are completely indecipherable.
So let me ask you about the UM claim. I see it just in paragraph 53, and you know it just baldly asserts that Secura never paid the remaining $17,500 balance to the plaintiff after Schwant's lawyer said, we're refusing it, pay it to the plaintiff. If we were to affirm the dismissal of that claim on the basis that it isn't fully fleshed out or under a Rule 56 failure to be supported by competent evidence, and I'm going to ask you that next, but what becomes, does the appellant have a $17,500 claim for UM benefits, and will that be something subject to separate litigation? What will happen to that claim?
Yeah, I don't have the answer for that for you, Judge Bjorkman. I saw the allegations in the complaint after the hearing, and I heard Mr. White's argument today in terms of the inferences that can be drawn from that, and I quite frankly completely disagree.
Can I ask you this? I'm struggling with whether we should be reviewing this dismissal through the Rule 12 or Rule 56 lens, because as you already noted, we had motion to dismiss that's general because of the nature of the allegations of the complaint. We have response in terms of affidavit. We have a motion to amend. I read the district court's order to sort of rely on some of the evidence that, you know, the evidence presented, not only the affidavit but other evidence. I also see, you know, references to Attorney Connolly being the appellant's attorney in the district court's order. So would we be better to view this under the Rule 56 lens and evaluate, for example, the UM claim in terms of competency of the evidence to support it?
I think the court certainly could. When we filed the motion, the only reference that we made to the matters outside the pleadings were matters that the court could take judicial notice of on a Rule 12 motion, and that was, here are the things that were in the record before the district court on other cases. And so I think the court could have taken judicial notice of that. But I certainly think the other approach that the court could take to resolve some of these issues is to say, well, it's just a Rule 56 issue, because the appellant did, I believe, Mr. Qualvog did submit more than like 3,000 pages of material. I don't remember how much it was. It was significant, and there was reference to all the material being on a flash drive. But I want to go back to kind of the overarching principle in this case, And the overarching principle really in this case is that, there's obviously a very unfortunate, very tragic accident.
Can we come back to Judge Bjorkman's question, though? I mean, if, let's just say hypothetically that appellant is entitled to this $17,500. If we affirm this, don't we have a decision from the district court that he is not entitled to that money, so there wouldn't be he wouldn't have some other ability to collect that money from the insurance company?
Well, so I think the question would be, does res judicata or collateral estoppel apply at that point that then precludes him from subsequently litigating that issue? And
the district court, I mean, explicitly grants judgment on his claim with regard to that money, correct? At the end of, on page 18 and 19 of the district court's order.
You're correct, Your Honor.
So why wouldn't res judicata attach and he's would be precluded from seeking that money from the insurance? Why wouldn't that be the argument that you, that the insurance company would make when he then comes to the insurance company saying, I'm entitled to this money? Under my hypothetical that he is, in fact, entitled to this money.
Sure. And Your Honor, I didn't mean to kind of flippantly laugh there. I was chuckling to myself because I just finished briefing an issue preclusion on a Wisconsin case that's up on appeal right now. And so I don't have Minnesota law when it comes to res judicata and collateral estoppel readily in my brain right now. And as to whether in Minnesota you would have a conclusion that if there's a motion to dismiss filed over an issue like this and it's granted, and I just simply don't recall under
and
Minnesota
specifically
law.
Specifically addressed in the order. I mean, it would be one thing if this was like the duty to inform claim where I think the district court just kind of does not really address the issue in its order. I mean, here with respect to the, I think you call it UIM, is that the?
Well, it's.
With respect to that issue, I mean, we have the district court actually reaching it and making a decision. And wouldn't that then, I guess I'm not, it's not clear to me why this wouldn't be binding on his future request to the insurance company to get this money. If under my hypothetical that he's entitled to it.
There's certainly a danger there. I think the bigger question is there any entitlement to that money? And I quite frankly did not follow in the complaint at all how exactly it is that this claim arises. I mean, I heard Mr. White's hypothetical that, it, you know, perhaps what happened was somebody said, look, there's this amount of UM coverage that's available under the complaint. You guys get together and figure it out. That's certainly not what's pled in the complaint. What's pled in the complaint is that there is a UM claim that Mr. Qualvog makes that, and that, I believe, let me pull up my notes, that Secura never paid $17,500 of the UM claim, and that Mr. Schwant's attorney told Bill Harry that he was disclaiming that amount and to give it to Mr. Qualvog. And from that, I'm having, quite frankly, a difficult time understanding how $17,500 of a UM claim that Mr. Qualvog made was awarded to Mr. Schwant, and then how Mr. Schwant's attorney could then say, okay, well, we don't want the money, so give it to somebody else, and that would somehow be binding on Secura.
Was Mr. Harry an arbitrator or something?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor.
I couldn't tell from the
record. I couldn't.
It seems so simplistic to just assign your benefit right. So, well, all right. Quite frankly, I
can't tell either. But I think
But isn't this the point of notice pleading that there should have been some development? I mean, isn't there an argument here that we're talking about a pro se plaintiff who's filing a complaint, and isn't the point of notice pleading that you are on notice that he thinks that there's a $17,500 UM money that's in dispute, and aren't you on notice sufficient to flesh out that claim? I guess that's my question.
I don't think so, Your Honor. Okay. And I think my comment at the hearing is all the proof you need that we weren't on notice because of the way that the complaint was drafted. I mean, there has to at least be some, here's what the facts are, here's what the legal theory is that entitles me to recover this money. And I still don't see any of that in the actual complaint itself. I think turning to the main issue that Mr. White discussed, throughout most of his time when he was at the podium, this issue of the right to decline coverage. I think the court has identified in its questioning of Mr. White the potential concerns here from a policy perspective. I mean, Mr. Qualvog in this case tendered the defense to Secura. Secura hired a lawyer to represent him, and under the insurance policy, which, Judge Bjorkman, you asked whether that was in the record, I don't recall specifically whether it was, but if it is, you can find it at Doc 6, Exhibit L, that's Secura's complaint and intervention. And in that complaint and intervention, it specifically notes that when Secura accepted the tender in this case, that under the insurance policy it issued to Mr. Qualvog, it had complete authority to control the direction that the litigation went into and the right to settle that litigation. That was their right. And at the hearing in Mr. Schwann's case, Mr. Qualvog repeatedly acknowledged that Secura had the right to settle this case that had been brought by Mr. Schwann. I mean, the insurance coverage in this case that Secura provided to Mr. Qualvog was $1.3 million. They settled Mr. Schwann's case, according to the documents in the record, for $250,000. I think the concern that the court has identified was saying, well, you have an obligation if the insurance company is aware that there's some sort of conflict between what the claims adjuster wants to do in terms of settlement and what the insured wants to do in terms of settlement, that they have an obligation to tell the insured, look, you can decline that coverage. Is that it could lead to significant additional litigation, and it could also lead to exposure for third parties who are making claims against the insured.
And I talked with Mr. White a lot about this, and you know he is suggesting that the law of Minnesota be clarified to provide a new duty or a new way for the insured and the insurer's relationship to be defined around issues where there's conflict. I mean, there's been other contexts involving insurance where, in fact, courts have developed, you know, Schmidt, there's a bunch of different things, settlement. Why is it inappropriate for us to consider the kind of clarification of Minnesota law that Mr. White is suggesting?
I think
recognizing these are unique circumstances.
Yeah, I think from a policy perspective, Your Honor, it's going to lead to significant additional litigation, and it's going to open up a can of worms that the court probably didn't intend to. So, for example, let's say that there is a disclaimer of coverage in this case. Mr. Qualvog, Secura reaches out and says, look, if you don't want this coverage here, sign right here and you'll disclaim coverage. Well, what's Mr. Schwann supposed to do? I mean, Mr. Qualvog may have the money to pay whatever the judgment is against that Mr. Schwann gets against him, but is Mr. Qualvog's disclaimer of coverages to Secura, does that bind Mr. Schwann? I mean, can Mr. Schwant then turn around and, in a subsequent case, sue Secura and Mr. Qualvog and say, I'm entitled to coverage here under this policy when Mr. Qualvog decided to disclaim it? I'm out of time, so I'll end right there.
You are. Thank you. Rebuttal.
Let me see if I can address very briefly four major issues that I kind of drew out of the questioning. First of all, the quality of the complaint is something that counsel has raised on a number of occasions, both before this court in briefing, now at oral argument, and before the district court. There is a simple remedy to that, which is a motion for a more definite statement as contained in our rules of civil procedure. We do it when we get complaints that we can't track exactly what's going on, and we want the plaintiff or the other side to tell us what's going on. And that would have been the simple remedy here and would have avoided all of the issues about trying to guess at what the claims are and so forth.
What's Second, it about any of the complaints as, or any of the allegations of the complaint as alleged, that under current Minnesota law would state a valid claim? I mean, given the, you know, start going back to Short versus Dareland, which defines the duty to defend and indemnify and contextualizes duties to investigate and inform around settlement within policy limits. It seems to me that the allegations don't implicate that case law.
I believe that it does, Your Honor, and if you look at the reply brief, it's spelled out a little better than it is in the appellant's brief initially, and I will acknowledge that. And that is the duty to investigate. And specifically, as this court will recall, if you look back at the original Favog opinion in which you were involved, there was a big issue about the quality of the state patrol investigation. The state patrol investigation became kind of the foundation for all of the liability analysis of what occurred between
whether the speed was a cause of the accident.
Whether the speed and the truck's activity and so forth.
And the people that your client wants to depose in this case were deposed and testified, some of them, at trial.
Exactly, Your Honor. But there were issues that were not addressed because they were found out later, and that's the Rule 60 part of that original opinion, where, again, there was no discovery allowed. And what exists in this case is 2 days after the mediation, the district court had ordered the depositions to be taken. And so that would have, if Secura had said, no, we're not going to mediate till we get to the bottom of the state patrol's investigation, then those depositions would have occurred and Secura would have completed its investigation of the underlying complaint. Because if the underlying complaint is invalid, or if the underlying investigation by the state patrol is invalid, that throws a question into basically everything about what happened at the time of this particular accident.
How does that implicate the duty of the insurance company in the context of defense and indemnity, which is all about doing the investigation sufficient to resolve the case within the policy limit?
Well, Your Honor, the problem here is that Mr. Kvalvog is being sued for, among other things, in the Schwant case, for improperly allowing his son to drive. That raises the question of his son's response to the semi that, by all of the testimony, was encroaching on his lane. That then directly implicates the quality of the State Patrol investigation in terms of how what caused all of the injuries, the two deaths and the two injuries, to the folks who were passenger or who were in the Kvalvog vehicle. So it directly implicates Mr. Kvalvog in his, as the theory of you shouldn't have allowed your son to drive, because the quality of the son's response then becomes the material issue. But let me go to another issue that I think is real important to address here, and that is the right to disclaim coverage, where we've had this long
could
colloquy.
In your short time remaining, could I actually have you respond to Judge Bjorkman's question about whether or not it is appropriate to consider this under the Rule 56 standard as opposed to the Rule 12 standard?
I do not believe it's appropriate to consider it under the Rule 56 standard, Your Honor. Again, we're dealing with a pro se plaintiff. We're dealing with a situation where there was no discovery at all. So a lot of the questions that the court has asked and that I've asked in my own head have never been answered because there's no discovery, principally around the 17-5, but there's a lot of other stuff as well. But the ABA opinion, I think, gives the answer, Judge Bjorkman, to this whole question, because the ABA says, lawyers, you have a duty to inform your insured that you can bail from your insurance coverage. If there is no duty to get out of the insurance coverage, there's no duty on a lawyer to disclose it. So the duty has to exist, at least in the opinion of the American Bar Association.
That's a duty as between the lawyer and the client, right?
That's correct,
Your Honor. That's what we said in our 2023. I mean, this court is in the underlying tort claim here, Schwant versus Park Christian.
Judge Werke, I know I'm really abusing the time here. May I answer?
Answer the question.
Yes, Your Honor, that's what you said. The duty is between, or that duty exists. But the point here that I'm making is not exactly who has the duty to inform. I argue that the insurance carrier should undertake that duty because that's the relationship, and that you are now putting a defense counsel in between the insurer and the insured on a coverage question, which, Lord knows.
Well, this isn't a coverage question.
It is, Your Honor, because if I disclaim coverage.
He doesn't want coverage, yeah.
If I disclaim coverage, now there's a theoretical coverage dispute. So you don't want to put the defense lawyer in that box, and you know, defense lawyers are loath to get there, and so the duty ought to be on the insurance carrier. So we would, again, ask the court to reverse and remand the matter for further proceedings.
Thank you, Mr. White, as well as Mr. Wills. The matters were well argued. A decision will be forthcoming within 90 days, a statutory time frame. That does conclude our oral argument calendar. Court is in recess.
All rise.